I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We have an American conversation, we say, with global attitude. This is another take on Cuba, the Cuban Revolution in transition. Our guest is Adrian Lopez Denis, a historian here at Brown University. He says, what Cuba's all about for me is the politics of the body and modernity, which is to say medicine, public health, the residue of slavery, men, women, under empire, in revolution. Adrian, you are our native guide to Cuba in transition, from Fidel Castro to his brother Raul, and then beyond, who knows. May I just say, for Americans, it's often hard to see Cuba behind Fidel. Sometimes it's hard to see Fidel behind the cigar. What do you see going on in Cuba today?
One of the key things to understand the island is to understand the fact that the revolution is too big to be reduced to a person, of course. And the person is too complicated to be reduced to a cigar.
It was so funny that both The Economist magazine and The New Yorker had almost exactly the same cover of the man, his cigar smoke, and that butt.
It is just an example of how Cuba gets reduced. Cuba gets reduced to Fidel. Fidel gets reduced to the cigar. The guy quit smoking 40 years ago, but still we see it. We see him through the cigar, and we see Cuba through him. And I think that it's just our lens is the, or let's say it's the Anglo-American lens, what determines what we get.
So what's changing here, Adrian? We hear about huge division in Cuba, between Cuba and Miami, but between factions on the island. Some people are predicting civil war after Raul. What's your expectation?
Well, I see very little division, and I definitely don't see a possibility of a civil war.
Really?
I just see a country that can be perceived from the outside and from the top as a country marked by the Cold War. And from below is a country that found its own way to get over the Cold War, basically. And young people don't think in the terms of the Cold War. They don't remember it. They don't think in those terms. Every time we talk about changes for the future of Cuba, the referential points are 40 years old. Mm. So I don't know how the future can be a structure around notions that are so old, basically.
Talk about the late 80s generation or 90s, special period when the Soviets ran out of money and interest, when Venezuela stepped in to some degree, and when Cuba survived on its own in many ways. What's on their minds?
Survival. And it's not survival of the fittest. This is not a Darwinian environment, necessarily. This is, we cannot minimize the unintended consequences of the Cuban Revolution. We cannot minimize the fact that by equalizing income levels and, for the most part, erasing the old established divisions of class, although, of course, the divisions along gender and racial lines remain, and some would say deepen. But class divisions were essential part of what Cuba was all about, got pretty much erased by the fact of the Cuban Revolution. So one unintended consequence of that transformation was that people created horizontal networks of solidarity, facing a state that controls public spaces in a very pervasive way. People developed alternatives to it. They cross all divisions. Mm. It's a network of survival. So you, when you need to survive, you cannot look at the ideology or the gender or the race of the person you're interacting with. You cannot be that picky. The main source of stability in Cuba is not the repression of the government, of course. It's not the lack of resources, the lack of public spaces. It's the fact that below the surface, there's a lot of public spaces at work, semi-public spaces, in which people realize a lot of their political life, a lot of their social life, and that is a source of stability, and people want to preserve and protect that. Extended family networks are very important in Cuba. Fictions can, religious family is essential to understand Cuban popular culture, understanding that when you get initiated into Santeria, you get brothers and sisters and parents and grandparents and uncles. And basically, you build another network on top of the network you already have.
historians can emphasize the great clashes and breakpoints. The emphasis I get from you is of the continuities, the long threads in the Cuban society, strongman rule, a bottom-up economy, the legacies of slavery, divisions of race. Where would you emphasize the qualities of Cuban life that have not been radically disrupted by the revolution, even 50 years now?
Well, first we need to understand that the revolution is built as some sort of radical rupture with the past, but has to be understood outside its own iconic profile. The revolution portrays itself as this radical transformation. In the process of doing that, invented a past for Cuba that was not there to emphasize how different Cuba was. So if we buy into that logic, then the transformation seems very dramatic. But if we look at underlying and deeper currents, then the transformations are less obvious. In many areas, the Cuban Revolution didn't reach too deep. And also we have to separate the intended consequences, the plan, the project, the ideas from the unintended consequences and what actually really happened.
Sort out the big changes and then the foundation stones of old Cuba that are still there.
Well, I can tell you, this is a matter of inventories and laundry lists, and I don't want to overwhelm you with this, but there's one example that will make very clear. You have in the early years of the revolution, they passed a law, the urban reform, in which everybody that was living in a house would become the owner of the house. And that was overnight. And every person can have only one home. So if you were, if you had a lot of apartments and you were renting them, you had to choose one, stay there, that's your home. Hmm. Everybody else that is renting your apartment becomes the owner. And there is a little bit of a payment settlement involved in this, but it's symbolic. And the government covered that. And overnight, you got a city like Havana in which there was a chronic housing shortage for centuries. Set on is housing dilemma, especially for the poor. That was essential. All of a sudden, you're spending half of your income on rent. And then all of a sudden, that income is free. You can spend it on food. You can spend it on clothing. And for a lot of people, it was a life-changing moment. Hmm. You know, I'm renting right now. If you told me that my home is mine, I would throw a big party, you know, and I would support you for a while too. So, I mean, it's not a small thing. Now, the unintended consequences was also that because of that, the housing markets of Cuba disappeared pretty much for the most part, the formal ones. When all on the ground through swaps and exchange, informal exchange of money. If you wanna have a home, you have to be very creative in Cuba, because basically there is no incentive to build homes. The government builds homes at a very slow pace, and there's a huge housing shortage now. That is not to minimize the effect that initial transformation in the 60s had, but it's to see it in perspective. It explains a lot of the support that the revolution got at the beginning, and it also explains a lot of the discontent that exists today. The same event. There's always another side to the same coin. This is not that the revolution has good things and bad things. It's that the same things, the same event, when it ripples through society and through the decades, could have completely different consequences. One's are the intended short-term consequences of first solving a housing shortage, second, gaining a huge amount of support for the government. Then the long-term consequences, creating an even bigger housing shortage and having an even bigger discontent. But that takes 30, 40 years. So that's what we need to understand to understand the Cuban Revolution, phenomena like this. And we have an example like that in pretty much every area.
I was going to say, give us another example of the ways in which informal reality and a kind of popular creative response has overwhelmed the outside impression of an all-powerful government.
Well, you have the fall of the Berlin Wall. You have the end of the Cold War and the end of the support of the Soviet Union subsidies start coming in. There were $5 billion a year, sizable for the size of the Cuban economy. But the most important thing is they were strategic. It was not the value of the monetary value, but the resources themselves. Food for animals, food for people, wheat, oil, basic key elements in to run a country. And especially to run a country that is based on a populist redistribution formula that requires handling large amounts of resources down to the population because you're not allowing them to get them themselves. So you have to hand it to them. The revolution, the government lost its ability to hand out large amounts of resources to the population in a matter of 3 weeks. I mean, this was something that we were always on that scene that if the Russian ship is late 1 week, we have shortages in Havana. We always were like that through the 70s and 80s. At the end of the 80s, that was almost solved in the sense that there were enough Russian ships coming. The Russians were paying for the war. The Cubans were fighting in Angola. And part of the payment was, you know, we need those Russian ships in time. We don't want social unrest in Havana. So they were getting in every week. And then all of a sudden, they just stopped coming. Hmm. And in a matter of weeks, the whole country got paralyzed. The cars literally stopped in the middle of the road because they didn't have more gas to keep going and there was no more gas to buy. And when you look at whatever, 35% drop on the gross domestic product, 75% drop on imports, you know, the government was relatively slow to react. The people couldn't afford to be slow. You cannot afford to be slow if you had to eat that month. You cannot wait until, you know, things settle internationally. And the responses down the road shows you that, you know, the legalization of the dollar, the opening of the economy, the boom of tourism, all these measures that were very much against the party politics of Cuba. They took a while. The reactions of the people had to be immediate because people had absolutely no cushion. They involved always a huge amount of creativity. So you had to invent them, reinvent them. You had to reinvent the market. You had to reinvent, everything, basically.
Adrian, speaking of what survived, I liked your line at the beginning that the apartment dweller who suddenly owns his housing, first instinct would be to throw a party. Mm-hmm. That party-giving, pleasure-loving energy that we associate with Cuba, maybe a cliché, but surely has survived the commissars, the Eastern European ideology of these very, very serious people who think they're running everything. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? What does it tell you about the continuity of the informal rules of a society?
Well, one important thing to understand is that the Cuban commissars were very different from the Eastern European ones in the sense that, you know, it starts at the top. The Cuban Revolution was designed to be a different revolution, to be a revolution of the 60s, you know. And it was designed to be more flexible, less Russian, let's say. Of course, eventually became more Russian, more East German. But that doesn't matter. I mean, the culture of informality was coming from the top down, not only from the bottom up. That the top-down management took a while for these kids that came down from the Sierra Maestra to become bureaucrats. Took a decade. They were not bureaucrats. They were improvisers. They were also young people throwing a party, basically a victory lap. And that victory lap took 10 years, basically, until Cuba got first more responsibility to the Soviet Union, meaning you had to play by the Soviet book. Popular culture that was basically stimulated by the revolution. The revolution was a big, let's change, let's get disorganized. Let's break away from the order of the dictatorship of Batista and the discipline and the military and the soldiers. Let's destroy the parking meters and we can park in the street without paying because what is that? You know, why should we pay for parking? You know, that kind of anarchist dimension. It has a strong anarchist dimension. The second thing we need to understand is that the culture of informality has really deep roots in Cuban culture in general. It's the Cuban way of doing things. It's been the Cuban way of doing things for quite a while. So the revolution just kind of plugged into that way of doing things that is, people say that is basically an anti-modern or non-modern way of doing things. I see it as a different form of modernity now. Mm. Getting things done with less stress. And, I mean, it's the definition of the pursuit of happiness right there. It's a pleasure-seeking culture at many levels. That is a cliche, but it happens to be a cliche that actually works. And it goes down to the fact that we were a society. Cuban society became very wealthy very fast in the early 19th century. Under became the main exporter of sugar in the world. Cuban slavery provided the elites with very comfortable living. They were more millionaires in Cuba than anywhere else at the beginning of the 19th century per capita. Of course, then the people on the bottom that need to find mechanisms to cope with things like slavery, for example, develop also alternatives to express, to find and express pleasure. This is an obvious response to oppression. I think that the people seeing that the most obvious response to oppression is getting all depressed and then organizing a revolution and fighting back. But the normal response to oppression is, organizing a good carnival party once a year. Mm. So it takes you to the next year because you know that you're there for the long run. Revolutions are exceptions. The rule is the opposite. The rule is that people, oppressed people, live oppressed for many, many years. And they know that. And so they find ways to, handle life between these big rupturing moments. No? And those things are from below and from the top. But they're different. I mean, the happy Afro-Cuban drummer is happy only to a point. Now, oppression is there, inequality is there, and back in the day and now. So it's not a mask. It's a mechanism for creating social capital, for moving forward, for seeding hope. But it's not just that either. It's not that people are oblivious to what is going on around them or ignorant of their position in society or just, drunk and happy all day. People are actually working towards their personal goals and using these parties as mechanisms to generate more social capital.
Two more big questions for me. One has to do with race in Cuba, and the other has to do with the realities, informal and otherwise, in relations with the United States. How much has the revolution changed racial reality in Cuba, and what is the agenda today?
This is a very difficult question. There's some work done in this area, but it's definitely not enough for us to draw strong conclusions. I can tell you what my impressionistic views on this are. On the one hand, the Cuban revolution, the revolutionary idea of race is class, mostly, for the most part. So if we eliminate class differences, we're going to contribute to the social mobility of the Afro-Cuban population. Because there's a strong correlation between race and class in Cuba, between, the darker your skin, the lower your position in society. That happens in any society that goes through slavery. Because of that reality, of course, transforming the class structure of society will contribute to the social mobility of the Afro-Cuban population. But, of course, again, that is only if we reduce the problem of race in Cuba to the socioeconomic dimensions, and only if we say that class explains in itself the distinctions at play. Those are two different phenomena, but those are very important, both of them. If you reduce it to socioeconomic things and you say, well, the only thing that we need to do is to uplift economically this group of people and that will solve the problem. This is a top-down paternalistic approach to race differences everywhere. You basically accomplish very little in areas that are very important, like political representation, public spaces, prejudice, affirmative action, access to education, because all of those things are not just, if you get 10% more income, you're going to get 10% more respect. That's not the case. It's never the case. It's never the case in Cuba. It's never the case anywhere, I think. And that notion of a colorblind solution to the race problem that is pervasive throughout Latin America is part of the illusions of the Latin American Euro-Creole middle classes about what race is about. They don't see it as their problem. They don't see it as something that they are part of, you know, they're part of the problem. Mm-hmm. They only see it as something that comes from the past and they could be a part of the solution. The solution will always be top-down. The solution will always be a form of social engineering. It seems to fail every time it's tried. The Cuban Revolution has been the most radical attempt to really do that at a deeper level. And the failure is obvious. In areas like gender equality, the Cuban Revolution was much more accomplished. The policy was more comprehensive. It addressed the cultural, it went after the symbolic, and it did, the Cuban Revolution mounted a big program the Cuban Revolution was never feminist, but it was much more comprehensive in its attempt to do social engineering and transforming attitudes of men towards women than it was in its very weak attempt to transform the attitudes of white people in Cuba towards black people. That is a big thing. The other thing is that the leadership of the Cuban Revolution was terrified of the possibility of political mobilization of the African population.
Yes.
Cuban elites and middle classes have been terrified of that for 200 years since the Haitian Revolution. It hasn't stopped. It's a fear that runs deep in the culture. It's a consequence, another consequence of slavery. You had that fear in every society that goes through slavery. The fear of the barbarian is a myth. It runs deep. It's the saddest part of all this story. And that is where I think everything that the Cuban Revolution tried to do in the social arena and the economic arena failed because the government decided that they cannot allow the African population to organize itself. The African population was there to receive what the government would give and be grateful, not to fight for more. The consequence is that there's more people in prison today in Cuba than anywhere else in the world. And nobody knows how many people are in prison in Cuba, or maybe the government knows, but nobody else knows. And the African population is overrepresented in the prison population. Mm. And that is the most obvious sign that something is really going deeply wrong in your country in terms of racial politics. Mm. Basically, if you want to understand a country, you have to go to the prisons. And we're not talking about the 300 political prisoners. We're not talking about that. That is a footnote. We're talking about the more or less 200,000 people.
On what kinds of charges, excluding politics?
Being black.
Mm.
Stealing a chicken. Surviving. All this informality is illegal. All this informality that I was celebrating a few minutes ago is illegal. Mm. And the government sometimes finds that it's a little clampdown is needed. And the people that pay the price are the people that are more active in the informal economy, the people that are more creative. And it's the same creativity that goes into playing jazz. It's not much different from that. You know, it's talking to other people, getting along, being able to improvise, you know? Mm. And so you get an African population that is being for centuries at the bottom of society that has been needing these connections, these networks more than anybody else. It's been developing these networks since the times of slavery. They are the masters of doing this in Cuba. And you get a government that doesn't understand the vitality and the productivity of these networks and tries to substitute them from, you know, put instead of them a top-down system that really doesn't work. So there you go.
When people talk about this transition to Raul and after Raul, I've heard you say, Adrian, that only George W. Bush thinks that these next 5 years are in some way really crucial, really important, really interesting. What do you mean by that?
Well, people in Cuba stopped believing that it's all about the government many, many years ago.
Hmm.
And they stopped believing that it's all about having Fidel Castro and not having Fidel Castro. It's not about that. It's never been about that. The government in Cuba is a bureaucracy, you know. It's not a one-man business. It's never been. It's a bureaucracy. It's a group of people making decisions. And it's not a very efficient one. So it doesn't run that deep as we think. You know, it doesn't reach that far. So reducing understanding of Cuban society to the government, and then reducing understanding of the government to the Castro brothers is just not very realistic.
Last question. We're going to have a new president, a new government in this country, one way or the other. How might it be different, especially when, as you say, the actual reality of the relationship is not this all-out confrontation that's usually emphasized in the formal talk? There are so many transnational households. There's so much money still going back and forth, even real agricultural trade, despite the embargo, despite the hostility. How might we surface something better, more productive, more actual, more real in the relationship between this country and Cuba?
Well, first of all, we have to think about the fact that Cuba has been sending strong signals in the last 2 years or so, since the midterm elections, signals of what Cuba sees as change, of the Cuban government sees as change.
I didn't get them. What were the signals?
You know, Fidel Castro retired. This is a symbolic move. He doesn't need to step down. He could just die in office. You know, he doesn't really need to step down at all. There's no pressure from below in Cuba in any way to transform the government. In fact, people in Cuba don't care about who's in power. That's not the issue. They're not going to get any pressure from below. What they're seeing is an international situation in which basically the Cuban government is running out of options. They see Chavez getting a little bit weaker. They see the United States going in the direction that is going to make, basically, that's going to make the end of the embargo possible. So they see there is a good time to start sending strong signals out. I mean, from the point of view of Cuban government, of the Cuban people, the retirement of Fidel Castro is nothing, is irrelevant. But for the outside world that sees, again, Cuba as the revolution and the revolution as Fidel Castro, that is a big thing.
What signal, Adrian, are they listening for from us, from our politics, where it's still the golden rule in Florida is to beat up on Castro's Cuba?
I don't think that Cuba expects too much from the United States right now. The Cuban Revolutionary Government has always had strong suspicions and never really trusted any American administration. It's not going to be different this time. It's not going to be the new dawn and everything's going to be different.
Because it's a pretty long history of just the opposite.
Well, it's just that I think it's prejudice. I mean, if you ask me, it's prejudice. If Cuban government is doing the same thing to the U.S. that the American government is doing to the Cuban government, right? It's perceiving the country as the state and the state as the president. That is just totally, again, unreal. No? We have millions of people on both sides, and they are arguing about figureheads. I mean, that's not what it's about. This country is not run by the president. It's run by these 500 families, no? And Cuba is not run by the Castro brothers. You know, it's more complicated than that. You cannot reduce it to get place in the media. There is a generational thing going on, running deep through Cuba right now. The fact that Fidel Castro and his followers within Cuba are very old, his enemies outside Cuba, the Cubans in Miami, for example, are even older. Mm-hmm. So this is an entire generation that is going out of the picture. The future of Cuba is not in their hands. Of course, they know that. And these people that were the last actors in that play are playing their last act. Mm-hmm. What they're trying to do is, you know, leave a lasting impression, basically, trying to shape, at least symbolically, the future of Cuba. They know that in terms of policy, in terms of economic policy, in terms of political structure, they cannot do anything. Both the ones in Cuba and the ones in Miami. What they're trying to do now is to compete for the symbolic future, for what is going to be the legacy of the Cuban Revolution in the imaginary of Cubans. Who's going to win the culture wars behind the Cold Wars in Cuba? How are Cubans going to judge these last 50 years? That is what is at stake right now, because let's say the revolution is over. Now, the thing is, what is going to be the echo that we're going to get from the Cuban Revolution is what is at stake right now. It's very little what is at stake, really. We should even stop thinking about that and move on.
Adrian Lopez, my ambition is to go to Cuba with you and listen again for ourselves. Where would you take us on the first day to give us a taste of the coming Cuba, the new Cuba, the young Cuba, the next Cuba?
Oh, I would take you to December 17th to the procession of San Lázaro Babaluaye to the AIDS Sanatorium and the Leprosarium of Rincón. It is sanctuary for lepers that was built in 1917. And a lot of people go there every year, around 60,000 people or so go there on December 17 and walk and pay promises to San Lázaro, to Babaluaye. It's healing, but it's healing of a very deep nature. You know, it's a healing of the nation. It's a healing of the body. It looks like an irrational people bleeding and singing African songs. But then when you look at it, the people are walking by this place that is unbelievable, this AIDS sanatorium that the government built to isolate people that were HIV positive. And they built this place that is just, it's like a prison. It's a perfect picture of the Cuban Revolution, because it's a hospital, a prison, a school. People are there because they want to. People are there that don't want to be there. It's like a microcosm of Cuba. And it's half a mile away from the sanatorium. Now it's voluntary. But it used to be enforced, no? But now it's voluntary. Now they have one in every province. They have 14 of those now. So it's one of those things, you know. We had the lowest rate of HIV positive people everywhere, I would say, in the Atlantic. It's one of spectacular, kind of external success of the Cuban Revolution. And then it's done by basically forcing isolation on people. And, you know, so you have, at the same time, you get free drugs if you're sick. And you get isolated and in prison. I would take you on and we get you to walk. It's like 3 miles with these people. So you can see what is at stake, what runs deep, what the Cold War invented, but, you know, the island that was there before. No. And it's the island's going to be thereafter.
My bags are packed. I'm ready to go. Adrian Lopez-Denis, thank you for a walking tour. I can't wait for the real one.
Thank you very much.